Just checking with the boss for the day. A lot of us have lived in the UK for most, if not all, of our lives. And if you haven't, some of us have lived here for a long time. So, if I tell you to go out into Kendal and tell people you meet what being a British citizen means, how would you feel? Where would you start? Okay, if I asked you to discuss with the person next to you here and now, would you agree? And if you disagreed, how would you resolve the difficulty? Now, I want you to imagine that you were one of that group of disciples who were told by Jesus to go out into the world and spread the gospel. So how would you begin? Where would you begin? What resources do you have? Your memory of what Jesus taught? The things other people can remember? The Holy Spirit reminding you? If you're very lucky, you might have a rudimentary collection of stories and sayings someone's written down. We know that there were a number of these circulating because the gospel writers use them, which is why sometimes in the gospels you have exactly the same words. But that is it. You don't have the gospels because they weren't written then. And then Paul comes along and he travels and begins to share the message of Jesus. And very early on, if you read Paul's letters, you will see that problems begin to arise. Now, the Old Testament says baby boys should be circumcised. Jesus said he had not come to abolish the law. So, when a guy becomes a Christian, should we circumcise him? If you read in Acts, you'll see that a council was convened in Jerusalem to look at this very problem. And then we know that Paul began to write to some of those early congregations to help them with their problems and, many cases, their misunderstandings. And he began to write those letters much earlier than the Gospels. And you'll notice that many of Paul's letters, or most of Paul's letters, were theological in nature, helping people to formulate what it was they believed. The Gospels, yes, they have a theological aspect too, but they're trying to tell Jesus' story and write down his teaching. And so, if you look in Paul's letters, you will see that one of the things he did to help people was to formulate a creed. And as we've already been told, we're going to start a series on the creed, and this is your introduction. We're going to fit it around other things. And Michael, who's the choir wag, reminded us that we have descended into hell, followed by Mayor's Sunday, followed by we will rise to life. You can make of that what you will. Anyway, we have an early creed. In Corinthians chapter 15, we see a very early creed. And there's another one in Philippians. And we know that these letters might have been written to one church, but they were copied and sent round to other churches as well. So a very early creed that tries to encapsulate what it is that people should believe. And we find that that began in those first decades, and it's continued on and on. Now, people talk about the early church sometimes as if everything was sweetness and light. They shared their belongings and all that sort of stuff. But actually, there were huge differences of opinion about what was true and what was not. In the first 100 years, there was Arius. He came along and said Jesus was inferior to the Father. And there was a guy called Marcion who went about saying, there must be two gods, a higher one and a lower one, because Marcion couldn't reconcile the God of the Old Testament with the God of the New. And I could actually bore you to death with some of the others because I find it fascinating. People were grappling, genuinely grappling with questions like, was Jesus divine or was he not? Did the Holy Spirit work like this or did it work like that? And this is where the creeds come in. Formularies. They were developed, if you like, so everyone knew what was correct doctrine. And we say, don't we, everyone sings from the same hymn sheet. There were loads of them. Now, the Didache was about AD 60, and there were 11 different creeds we know of in the first 100 years, and some others that you will know about. We say the Apostles' Creed, don't we, which is formulated around 120, 250. The Nicene Creed, which we still use, around 325. And then there are others that some of you might have heard of, the Athanasian Creed, and so we go on right up until 1927, and there was an ecumenical creed of Lausanne. They were all trying to give us, if you like, a template, an outline of what it is we are going to believe. But that didn't actually solve all the problems. There were still splits. The Nicene Creed has in it something known as the Filioque Clause, that split the Eastern and the Western Church. And it was all to do with whether the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Father and the Son or just the Father. The fallout of that was even worse than Brexit. But generally, the aim of the creeds were to be unifying statements. Now, I don't know about you, but there are two things that help me feel connected with all those Christians that have gone before me, right the way down, so those first centuries. And I can say, whether I'm worshipping in a Choli or French or Church Slavonic, firstly, it's the Lord's Prayer. I was once in Westminster Cathedral, the Roman Catholic one, when over the loudspeaker, we were asked to stop where we were and to say the Lord's Prayer in whatever language came most easily to us. And all around me were people saying the Lord's Prayer in French and German and lots of languages I didn't recognize. It was a powerful act of unity. And secondly, there are the creeds. When I say the creed, remember they were written 325, 150, it ties me back to all those who've gone before me. And I'm united, too, with Christians around the world who, slightly different time zones, are saying those same words. There's another function of the creeds. If someone asks you what you believe, you might go, where do I start? If you know the creed, you have a template. You could actually recite it to someone or use it to expand. Now, some of you will know that some creeds we say, I believe, and some we say, we believe. Now, of course, we all have to make a personal commitment. We all have to be able to say, I believe. But when we recite the creeds together in church, we're affirming our communal belief. So, we seems more appropriate, I guess. But also, we can help, because if there's something you find difficult in the creed, or even can't commit to, you can actually say it knowing that someone around you probably will be able to say that and believe it at that moment. So as I said, we're going over the next few months to be looking at the creed in detail. And we're going to be using the Apostles' Creed. Now, why is it called the Apostles' Creed? Well, we find the earliest expression of it in a synod in Milan in 390, 4th century. Now, in the 4th century, they had some weird and wonderful beliefs, and one of them was that under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, each of the apostles had contributed an article of this creed. They didn't have the centuries of scholarship that we have, so forgive them. Anyway, it still kept that name, the Apostles' Creed. So you've had a whistle-stop tour where creeds came from and some of the uses. And we today are just going to look very briefly at the words at the very beginning of that creed. And it is, I believe in God, or we believe in God. Well, to be honest, so do many, many people, not just Christians, Muslims, Hindus, animists. If you read the OT, you'll see that each nation had its own God. And they believed that if your nation was powerful, it was because your God was powerful, and the reverse. In my home group, we were looking at Psalms 42 and 43, and the writer who was in exile is mocked by his enemies. They say, "Where is your God?" In other words, your God must be pretty poor, as he's not been able to protect you and you're in exile. People saw God as powerful. But while people could sense God's power, he didn't always have a name. It was Moses who was told that God's name was I Am Who I Am, Yahweh. We translate that as the Lord. And in Acts, remember in Athens, Paul sees an altar to an unknown God. And Paul's able to say to them that the God that you're worshiping is the God who made the world and everything in it. And then we had that reading from Revelation. And we see John trying to describe the indescribable, a majestic, awesome God. He had a vision of God, which, as someone said to me, makes it look as though he was on LSD. Well, could we do any better? And Elijah, he stood before the followers of Baal and he said, "The one before whom I stand is the living God." We believe in God, but what sort of God? I've picked out a few things to give you some ideas, but you'll have to wait until next time to find out more.